It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and it's Horticulture Day today. Coming up in a few minutes, Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis and ISU Extension horticulturist Richard Giron will be here to answer your questions. But we're going to start the hour with some Organic Gardening 101. The 16th Annual Iowa Organic Conference is coming up November 13th and 14th in Iowa City on the University of Iowa campus. The theme this year is Perennial Passion, Building Resilience into Organic Systems. And you can find out more, follow the link on our Twitter feed. I just put it up there. And one of the people behind that conference is Iowa State University Extension Organic Specialist Kathleen Dellett. She is here today. Hello, Kathleen.
Hello, Charity. How are you?
She's in Ames. Hello, Kathleen.
Hi, Charity. Can
Hi.
You hear me?
Yes, I can hear you now, which is
great.
Excellent. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
And let's just do some organic gardening basics, because I think a lot of people think I'm going to have a beautiful, fruitful, organic garden, and they start to run into some of the problems that can crop up and maybe do a little bit of backsliding. So right now, while we may be thinking about next spring or preparing our garden beds, if we want to have an organic garden in the spring, what should we be thinking about right now?
Okay, there's a lot of things you should be thinking about. One, if you can get a local source of manure for your garden, it's a good time to put it on and turn it under. We use dairy manure, which I think is the best because it has some carbon in it as opposed to just pure nitrogen. But there are all kinds of manure out there. And that's the good thing about gardening organically in Iowa is you have an ample source of manure around. If you just find your neighbors or well, if you're out in the country, your neighbors, but look for a local farm. They probably have some manure that they can give you to turn under in your garden this time of year.
Well, and with more and more backyard chickens around, is that a good source?
Excellent. Yeah, people have backyard chickens, rabbits. Those are all great to have, too.
All right, so look for manure. Mm-hmm. So maybe it's time to start thinking about amending that soil to make the soil more fertile. Is that what you're saying?
Right, and I'm glad you stopped me, because it would be very valuable if people can take a soil sample, just take maybe like 3 per 1,000 square feet of your garden, and send it off to Iowa State and get it analyzed. Chances are you're going to need nitrogen, because that's always a common need for soils in Iowa. But it'd be good to check your pH, because you want to have a pH of around 6.5 to 7. So you may need to add some lime, which is easy to get from your local garden supply store. So once you get your soil sample, but I'd say it's safe to apply manure and compost or composted manure, because chances are you're going to need to add nitrogen. But then the next thing is to think about what crops you're going to grow. And that it's a great time of year to start perusing the catalogs, the seed catalogs. And the basis of organic is based on prevention. So you want to get the most disease-resistant or disease-tolerant and insect-resistant or insect-tolerant varieties that are out there. And the good news is every year you see more and more of those. So I have a whole list of my favorites, but I don't know if you want me to go into those.
Well, maybe once we should continue covering kind of the basics, but if people have specific questions about the kinds of things they want to plant in the spring, then they can call in and ask you about those in particular. Maybe you can send them along on email as well. So, all right, you're looking ahead, you're thinking about the kinds of things you want to grow. Is there something that you should be thinking about as far as the sort of seed bank of weeds that you might already have in that soil?
That's a good question, too. Weeds are typically managed through tillage in organic systems. So, you know, by turning it under, by turning your manure under right now, you're going to do a lot to hopefully mitigate some weed seed germination. Also, planting a cover crop can work. Now, most gardeners don't do this, but we did it in our garden last year, and it worked phenomenally. Rye is the most common cover crop used in Iowa, and it's a very good one. So you can get rye seed from your local garden supply. If you want to be certified organic, it has to be a certified organic source of rye, and there's a lot of folks selling that now, like Welter seed. And just put that down about like a bushel an acre. Well, that's an acre rate, but and then it'll when it grows up in the spring to about 6 to 8 inches, you can till it under. That will really help with weed prevention. We do that in our agronomic crops, for example.
And is it too late to plant a cover crop this fall?
I don't think so, because with
because it feels like spring out there right now, right?
With global climate change, I'd say we can go all the way. Well, I remember one year I planted it November 15th and it came up fine.
Wow.
You'll get more growth when you plant it earlier, but you'll still get something if you plant it now.
And is that something you recommend for home gardeners too?
I think so. I think, you know, it's cheap. It's about, well, for organic seed, rye seed, it's $12 a bushel. So for $12, you can cover your whole garden and get that weed mitigation property. It also can add a little carbon to improve your soil. So I think it's worth it.
Well, and I know something that a lot of people worry about when they think about turning the soil this time of year would be erosion because of wind and weather during the winter months. So the cover crop could help with that, too.
Absolutely. And, yeah, I mean, particularly if you're on any sloping land. Of course, the ideal garden is on flat land.
So let's think about the spring. And when the weeds start to come up, that's a time that a lot of people, you know, you get the soil tilled and turned, you get things planted, everything looks perfect, and then you get busy, and suddenly you have all these weeds. So what do you recommend for weed control once you get things planted in the spring?
Sure. Yeah, I always have to put on two hats, gardening versus commercial, because for commercial crops or agronomic crops, we're out there with tillage. We use rotary hoeing and row cultivation. But for gardening, we use straw. And again, if you want to be certified organic, you need to get an organic source of straw. We use the straw from our organic plots. And oats or wheat, I think wheat is actually better than oats. It tends not to germinate as much if you have some seeds left in that straw. But oat straw, wheat straw work great for mulch. There's also other mulches you can use. There's some that are even made of fabric, but again, you need to check the source if you want to be certified organic. If you're just, you know, eating your own garden products or giving them to your neighbors, you don't have to worry about certification. You could use these other mulches that are on the market, plastic mulches, fabric mulches. There's a bunch of them out there.
But that's a great way to get ahead of the weeds, is to just get that soil covered, right?
I think so, yeah.
All right. How about pests? Because, of course, as we learn on Horticulture Day, all summer long, different pests crop up at different times. What kinds of precautions do you want to take other than buying pest-resistant seeds?
Right. Well, I'm glad Donald Lewis is here so he can help me out with anything I say wrong. Looking at him, smiling there. Again, it's based on prevention. So your crop rotations will help. They'll confuse the insects that are, for example, looking for corn and you moved it to another plot this year. So crop rotations really help. But then there are tactics that you can use during the season, like row covers for squash. I highly recommend them to keep the squash beetles, squash bugs out. Trap cropping. That's turning out to be a more important thing for both squash beetles and also, or cucumber beetles, and also, I know I just went to a conference in D.C. and everybody's talking about trap cropping for brown marmorated stink bug.
And what does trap cropping mean?
Trap cropping is when you plant a crop that will be attractive to the pest, and the new one on the block is this brown marmorated stink bug. So they're planting sunflowers and sesame, and I can't remember all the other trap crops, but that they are very attractive to this bug, and so the bug will go to them, to the sunflowers, instead of going to, for example, your tomatoes.
Okay, so you're planting something specifically for that pest, but it should keep them off your other plants.
Exactly. And then you have the option of leaving them there and merely watching them consume the sunflowers, or killing them in place, or the thing the home gardener always has available is hand picking. And I know some people make an art out of that. They'll put a nice soapy bucket around and just have joy of picking beetles off and swatch bugs and drowning them in the soapy water. So don't rule out hand picking. We spend a lot of time hand picking in our garden. There's also beneficial insects. So you want to attract those to your garden. You want to flowering plants. Alyssum is one of them that we plant that some beneficial wasps, for example, prefer. So anything to improve the biodiversity of your garden will help manage pests. And then last but not least, there are organic compliant insecticides. Again, I highly recommend checking with your certifier if you're going to use anything, because if you want to be certified organic and use something that's not organic compliant, you could lose your certification if you use the wrong thing. So nothing can have petroleum products in it. That's pretty easy to see on a label. And again, if you want me to go into the list of organic compliant insecticides we use in our organic research, I could do that.
Well, I think that it's just important to know that those possibilities are out there. So if you get into a situation where you think, I cannot overcome this by hand picking, I can't get ahead of this, you do have some other options that still can fit within that organic framework.
Exactly. And we have publications on the web. If you type in ISU organic or go to the extension store and type in the word organic, you can see we have an organic vegetable publication, a new one on composting, cover crops and crop rotations that'll talk about all these things.
Now, I want to mention again the Iowa Organic Conference coming up November 13th. And the theme for this year, perennial passion, building resilience into organic systems. Of course, a lot of us think about perennials as something you plant in your yard to be pretty every year. In 45 seconds or less, Kathleen, what role do perennials play in organic farming and gardening?
Well, I would like to go right to the speaker. He's coming from the Land Institute. If folks haven't heard about that, they should Google it. Their whole premise is that we need to perennialize our landscape, i.e. put more perennials into our farmscapes because they will build biodiversity and, you know, help against erosion and be there for the long term and also preserve pollinator habitat. And so at the Land Institute, they're actually working on some really forward-thinking crops like perennial chickpeas, for example. So, you know, you'd have these chickpeas that could survive the winter here, and also perennial wheat is another big crop they're working on. So you'd never have to replant.
Wow.
Just always have that crop
out there. Yeah, that's just amazing to think about. I think we'll see a lot of really interesting innovations in that field in the next few years. Kathleen Dellett, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And stay with us, of course, to answer questions. Iowa State University Extension Organic Specialist Kathleen Dellett. Again, the 16th Annual Iowa Organic Conference coming up November 13th and 14th in Iowa City on the University of Iowa campus. We tweeted out a link to the conference website. You can also find it online yourself, and registration is still open. In a moment, Donald Lewis, Iowa State University Extension entomologist, will be here along with ISU Extension horticulturist Richard Duran, and the three of my guests will answer your questions. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. With me, Iowa State University Extension organic specialist Kathleen Dellett, also joining us now, Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis. Hello, Donald.
Hello, Charity. Glad to be here.
Welcome to the show, and Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Duran. Hello, Richard.
Good morning.
And, of course, Donald, Richard, and Kathleen are all here to answer your questions about the plants and insects in your life. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Donald, with this, Kathleen was just mentioning how warm it's been lately, and that may give you a chance to plant a cover crop this fall, but it's also given second life to so many insects. There has been a population explosion, at least around my house. I mean, is this something that we're seeing all over the place?
Well, I think what we're seeing is just the prolonged fall of insects going into dormancy. Things like yellow jacket wasps have pretty much died of old age, but if there's a few of them around, they could still be active. The same with the paper wasps that were up under the eaves of your house. Most of them would have died by the beginning of November, but the temperatures have allowed them to persist. And, of course, our perennial favorites, the box elder bug and the multicolored Asian lady beetle, are always around in the fall as long as the temperatures are above their minimum operating temperature. So when it's 55 degrees or more and they're sitting in the sunshine, they're going to continue to fly as long as the temperatures allow, but they'll go into dormancy when normal temperatures resume.
Does this late warm spell, does it allow any insects to hatch that maybe would have just laid their eggs and left them alone for the winter months?
It's possible that things are a little out of sync, but there's a couple of environmental cues that go together in the development of most insects, and temperature is only one of those. The other one is day length. And as the days have gotten shorter, that's the other cue that insects are going to use to say, don't reproduce now. And so even though it's warm enough for them to be active, there may be some other overriding factor that's going to keep them from doing the wrong thing just because the weather has not been what they normally would have experienced. So, yes, there could be things that have continued to lay eggs into the season a little longer than normal, but those eggs are likely to make it through the winter, so it's not likely to help the insects to have this prolonged period as much as it's helping those of us who love being outside on these sunny, warm days.
Yeah, absolutely. Not a lot of mosquito bites going on right now.
Not a lot of mosquitoes, but they're still out there. You can still find some that haven't gone into dormancy, so that can happen. But, no, we're winding down, and we get to these precious few warm days with bright blue skies, and we'll just take them and enjoy them as long as they last.
All right. And we've got a bunch of flies that suddenly seem to be around our house, but they act like elderly flies. They're really easy to kill.
Yeah. Well, it's been a good year for cluster fly, which is also called attic fly, which is the one that gets on the south side of your house, and then it gets in, like, the box elder bugs. It gets into the wall voids. You'll find cluster flies on your windowsills almost every day of the winter when you're out in the country, and especially if your house is up on a high spot and an exposed silhouette, if your house is high like that, you'll get those cluster flies, and they are fairly sluggish. They just seem kind of dumb in a way. They just sort of sit there, but then they'll start buzzing on their backs and annoy you again.
All right, well, that sounds exactly like my house. You just described it. So I'm sure we'll see a lot more of them. Let's get to the phones. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Frida is on the line in Newton. Hi, Frida.
Hi there, Charity. I love your program. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question. I have a little ice cream bucket where I put my vegetable scraps in and crushed up eggshells, and that's the only thing. And I have what it's a little salad garden and the coffee grounds. Now, somebody tells me it's not good to put coffee grounds in the garden. Some of them say it's okay. I have very compacted, dense soil, and also a week ago, my youngest son, we put about 8 bags of leaves on my little spot, and he plowed it under and went through it several times. Is that good, not good, or what?
Well, as far as if you have a clay-type soil, adding organic matter is very beneficial. If you can get some compost, maybe from your city if they have a composting facility, and you can work that into the soil, that's going to help a lot. You can add the eggshells and things like
that.
Well, they contain some nutrients, for example, they do contain some nitrogen and some phosphate and potash, so they're okay. I would typically put those in a compost pot if I had one myself, where I would put in maybe some leaves, debris from the garden, grass clippings, my coffee grounds, the eggshells. All those are perfect for a compost pile.
All right, Frida, thank you so much for calling. I hope that answers your question. Next, let's go to Aaron in Iowa City. Hi, Aaron.
Hi. I have a question about a new garden that I will be helping with. The garden was pretty overgrown when we took over it this fall. I'm going to be working with kids in this space, and we are not allowed to use any sort of chemicals, and we aren't going to be able to rototill. And as we cleared out the space, there were tons and tons of weed seed you could see scattered about and a lot of weeds that we cleared from the area. How do I control this?
I think you're going to have to do some hoeing, hand pulling, and mulching, basically those three things. And make sure that you get the weeds before they go to seed. That's important so you can reduce the seed population. But basically cultivating, shallow cultivation, hand pulling, and mulching.
Right, and Kathleen was just saying straw on the ground. That sounds like a perfect application for that, right?
And you can use grass clippings, too, if you have those. Shredded leaves work fine. So anything that you might have in the landscape.
I'm just curious, why would they say no cultivation? Because if you immediately put in organic matter, organic containing materials like compost and leaves and straw, that would mitigate any carbon loss. Do they have a reason why they won't allow you to use a tiller?
It has to do with, so the garden in question is on school property, and it has to do with where the garden's located, and the soil is not real high quality. So I'm going to try to do some amending, but I'm not going to be able to run a tiller in there, but I should be able to get in there with, like, a hoe, whatnot.
A shovel, spade.
It just has to do with location and utilities and that sort of thing.
Gotcha.
All right. Well, yeah, good luck with that project, Erin.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for your call. Is that a kind of situation where covering, it sounds like it's not a huge space, covering the ground so things don't germinate in the spring, is that a good idea, like putting down some sort of a plastic
mulch
cover or something?
Well, mulch, as far as many of your annual weed seeds, for them to germinate, they need light, sunlight. And so if you cover the ground with, let's say, straw, grass clippings, shredded leaves, then the light doesn't reach the soil and they don't germinate. But every time that you hoe, you destroy the existing weeds, but you also bring up additional weed seed to the surface. So that's why you get more weeds later on. So mulching is very good.
And just to put in a plug for the conference, we're having some expert gardeners, Erin, that you might want to hear from Grow Johnson County, that'll be talking about life skill gardens.
Oh, terrific. All right. And again, that's coming up November 13th and 14th. And since Erin's right in Iowa City, super convenient. All right, let's go back to the phones. Don is on the line. Hello, Don.
Hello. I planted my garlic this week, and a couple of the cloves that I planted were discolored. And it made me think about a question I didn't know the answer to. Will the cloves that I plant actually become a part of the bulb that is harvested next year, or does that clove that I plant now disappear in some way?
It doesn't really disappear, but it should grow in size and divide, and so you'll have a number of cloves within that original bulb or corm.
Okay, so the clove I plant will actually still be there when I harvest next year?
Right, it should be. And if it's discolored, I would be kind of concerned that maybe there's a disease involved and maybe it may not develop into a nice, healthy specimen next spring and summer. So that might be a concern.
Yes. Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks a lot for your call, Don. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Rob is on the line next in Jefferson County. Oh, I guess Rob is not on the line in Jefferson County. So next up, we've got Eric in Algona. Hello, Eric.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a question. I have a sumac in my, I think it's a low-growing sumac, but it's in a flower bed, and we bought this house just a couple years ago, and it's gotten too big. When can I trim it back, and how far can I trim it back without killing it?
Well, sumac is a very tough, resilient plant. I would prefer to prune it in late winter, like in March.
Okay.
And you can prune it back. You can prune it back extensively, severely. Sumac suckers from the roots, and so it's going to come back quite vigorously when you do prune it back. But it's, like I said, a very tough, resilient plant. So I would wait and do it late winter, and you can prune it back severely.
Okay, thanks.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Here's a question for you, Donald, from Lori. She says, on two different years, including this one, we've observed over 100 monarchs resting up, clinging to the trees on the family farm during fall migration about 20 miles south of Waterloo. Both times there's been a strong wind from the south. Is this common in Iowa, or is this spot somehow unique and inviting in some way? Should we make an effort to add some nectar plants to this area next year?
Well, Lori's among the few still walking the face of the earth who get to see this phenomenon. It used to be quite common that these clusters of hundreds to thousands of monarchs would rest overnight on trees and shrubs as they're passing from Canada, Minnesota, Wisconsin on their way to south central Mexico. So we don't see those large clusters like we used to because the monarch population is much smaller than it used to be. And Lori's observation is very encouraging that it at least is still occurring to some people. Yes, monarch butterflies recharge their energy supply by feeding on nectar as they pass through. So nectar-producing plants at that time of the year would be most beneficial to the monarchs. Of course, we want nectar plants throughout the season for all of the pollinators and for all of the butterflies, but things like New England asters and others that are blooming in that period of mid-September till the end of the month would be the most beneficial for butterflies, and I hope she does diversify and provide more nectar for them.
All right, and is there, other than planting nectar plants, or maybe that will support them but not necessarily attract them, I know a lot of people would love to see monarchs gather on their property. Is there any way to make your property particularly attractive to them?
Not that I know of. I think those monarch trees, as we used to call them, those locations where the monarchs would stop and roost on their way, the monarchs pick them out themselves. I don't think we do anything to make one big green ash tree more attractive than another big green ash tree, but they do seem to have favorites, and they pick them out year after year. But I don't know what we can do to change the butterflies' method of choice, but diversifying the landscape is always a good thing.
All right, here's a question for Kathleen from Tyler in Kelowna, Illinois. I'm wondering if rye would still be a good cover crop for pumpkins since they get planted in late spring or early summer. If so, what kind of rye should I use?
Yeah, so I think there's a lot of research showing growing pumpkins in rye is definitely beneficial. We actually just use VNS, variety not stated, so I can't give you any specific recommendation for a variety of rye. I think pretty much any rye will do. What folks look for in rye is early maturing rye. If, for example, they want to use the roller crimper and roll crimp their rye down, we have some research going on that. And there's a variety called Aroostook that folks are saying is more early maturing. But in general, I don't think the variety is that important. Just make sure it's organic rye if you're certified organic.
All right. Let's go back to the phones. Bo is on the line in Des Moines. Hi, Bo.
Hi. I have a question about my strawberry plants. I have battled all year long with whiteflies, and I'm trying to get rid of them organically. I'm going to overwinter the plants and hopefully have the same plants in the spring. I'm wondering how to get rid of the whiteflies without chemicals.
Oh, without chemicals. That's a pretty broad area, but if we soften that up a little bit and say, okay, we can use some chemicals such as insecticidal soap, which would be an organic treatment, would be a non-toxic treatment to the environment, to the plant, and to you, that gives us an option. So insecticidal soap would be my first one. We're all scratching our heads, though, saying, are these June-bearing strawberries that you eat, or are you talking about a houseplant?
They are edible June-bearing strawberries.
Okay.
And, let me also mention that I've used neem oil on several occasions. I've also put two different groups of ladybugs, green lacewing,
okay,
and also praying mantis.
Yeah.
None of that has helped, and it seems like the whiteflies are winning.
And they likely are, especially when we move inside and we have the drier environment, the fewer predators to feed on them. I think the lacewings and ladybugs may have helped keep the population to a dull roar, but as their development comes to an end, the whiteflies are certainly going to reproduce more quickly. Praying mantid wouldn't look on the underside of a leaf and try to pick off something to eat. They're kind of lazy. They wait for food to come to them. So the praying mantids didn't help in this case, but the others might have. I think the insecticidal soap is still my suggestion. The neem oil works well as a growth regulator, but it's not a toxicant. That is, it's going to stop the growth of the whitefly nymph, but it's not going to kill the pupal stage, and it's not going to kill the adult stage. So it's a bit of an issue. Now, with both of these, neem oil and insecticidal soap, we need to hit the critter. So we're not talking sprinkling this stuff from above and letting it land on the leaf. We're talking about blowing the spray upward from the underside so that it attaches to the underside of the leaf and impinges or hits directly onto the insect. So this is an issue to get that thorough coverage onto the pest, not onto the plant, but onto the pest.
All right, Bo.
Is there a better time of day to do the spraying? And should I be concerned about them overwintering in the spring? Should I do something in the spring?
I'd like to keep
the population down.
I think we'll answer that right after the break.
You took the words right out of my mouth, Donald. All right, we are going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment with Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis, horticulturist Richard Giron, and organic specialist Kathleen Dellett. You can join the conversation at 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. With me, Iowa State University Extension Organic Specialist Kathleen Dellett, ISU Extension Entomologist Donald Lewis, and ISU Extension Horticulturist Richard Giron. They are here to answer your questions at 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And let's finish up Bo's questions there. First, the best time of day to spray if you're using neem oil.
Neem oil or insecticidal soap can be applied any time of day, but we try to avoid hot, dry conditions, so that's not likely to be an issue anymore this year. His second question had to do with, will they overwinter? And in general, white flies do not survive Iowa winters outdoors. They repopulate from the south in the spring, they survive in greenhouses, so we have them every summer, but probably not because they spent the winter here. However, if these are strawberries that are going to be under a layer of mulch outdoors through the winter, maybe there is a possibility, but the population should greatly decline over the year, over the winter, and not be as bad next year. Now, we're also not sure white fly is the right diagnosis, and if Bo is still listening, this would be a good one to have confirmed with the Iowa State University Plant and Insect Diagnostic Clinic. Let us take a look at the plants and make sure we're talking about the right thing and have given the right recommendations.
All right. Here's a question from Laurel in Grinnell. We'd like to plant heathers, lavender, and rosemary, and any other pretty shrubs that have some use for hedge-type areas around our homestead outside of Grinnell. Do you think this would work if we planted in the spring? Would seeds work, or do we need to transplant more mature plants?
Well, some plants just are not very well-suited to Iowa, to our climate. For example, heather is one that just doesn't like our weather. It doesn't like our cold, dry winters, our hot, humid summers, and so it doesn't do very well. Rosemary you could bring inside in the fall, possibly, so it should be a pot plant, but it's not something that would typically overwinter outside. So,
all right. So hedge-type pretty shrubs that might have some use. Any other suggestions?
Well, as far as hedges, I mean, there are a lot of shrubs that are suitable for hedges, everything from dogwoods, viburnums, lilacs, et cetera.
Rhododendron.
Ninebark.
All right.
Lots of choices, just not those.
Okay. All right. So time to go back to the drawing board and rethink some different options. Merle is on the line in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Merle.
Good morning.
Hi. What's your question?
Dry gluten meal is a product from wet corn milling. I have used it years and years ago lately for nitrogen for a lawn. Can you tell me what if that would be beneficial for a garden?
Yeah, it's used by gardeners. Again, I just have to always wear my certified organic hat that if you want to get anything certified organic, it has to come from an organic corn source. So just be aware of that. But otherwise, if you're just using your own food products from the garden, you can use any corn gluten meal. And in addition, as you mentioned, you're already providing nitrogen to your plants from it, but it also is a good organic herbicide in that it can help mitigate some issues with the weeds. We did use it in some research here and found that it was very effective with transplants, but with seeds, particularly small seeded crops, it was a little more difficult to control the weeds only with corn gluten meal.
Okay. All right. That's all I have then. Thank you very much.
All right, Merle, thanks a lot for your call. 866-780-9100. Teresa's on the line in Iowa City. Hi, Teresa.
Hello.
Hello. I have a question about zucchini. I have planted some several years, in fact, but this year I had about 6 plants. They had lots and lots of flowers, the male first, I think, and then the female, but I never got any zucchini except for one small one, and I don't know why.
That's kind of a mystery, too, because they tend to be very prolific bloomers.
Yes.
You do have the male and female flowers, and when the plants first begin to bloom, the vast majority are male. But typically within
I was checking them, lots of male flowers.
Right. But then very quickly you start to see quite a few females. And once you have that, basically you should get some pollination and fruit set. Now things can affect that. For example, if we have some, let's say, very hot weather, that might affect pollination. So the weather can affect it, but... they bloom so heavily that you should see quite a few fruits. I'm not quite sure why you only saw one.
Lack of pollination, lack of pollinators to cause pollination is sometimes an issue, but in the average garden, there are enough flies and bees of various types that will take care of itself. But that always comes up as a question. What if we don't have enough pollinators? Well, things like melons and zucchinis are where we're going to see that decline. But we can't say for sure that was the problem, but it is one consideration to put into the mix.
All right, so this is a mystery we're not going to be able to solve. Is there anything that she could think about for next year so she doesn't have the same issue?
I would assume that everything next year will be fine. That's my assumption.
Mine too.
I'm optimistic.
All right.
I say plant more flowers because bees love flowers. So
okay.
Bring in flowers early and
attract those pollinators.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right. Todd is on the line next in Algona. Hi, Todd.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
My question is, I'm seeing a lot of insect activity in my oak trees. We see a lot of woodpecker holes, and there's a lot of tip dieback at the top of the crown. And the area that I live in has a lot of oak, and we're seeing some of those trees that are starting to die 2 or 3 years after they show signs of this insect activity. I was wondering if you had an idea what that could be.
What was the insect activity that you noticed? Did you see actual insects in...
Not so much the insects themselves. I haven't seen any insects, but we can see some leaf chewing. There's some tunneling in the bark, some insect galleries, I think they're called.
Yeah.
And a lot of tip dieback.
Okay. Well, I don't think we have a happy story for you up there in Algona. What you're describing sound like secondary problems. The borer holes that you see, the borer galleries that you see are... after the fact, something else weakened the tree, something else diminished its resources, diminished its defenses, and beetles were able to attack. And that's the flat-headed borers that are under the bark, the round-headed borers that are in the wood. That's not really related to the leaf feeding that you may have seen, but the borer activity is not good news. Now, why did they decline? We'll probably never know. And we get this long, long list of problems that can occur over time, anything from too much water, not enough water, planted too deeply, planted too shallowly. There's a whole lot of issues that lead to these declines. So controlling insects is not likely to make a difference. Can we change the overall health of those trees? That's not going to be easy to do either. But an arborist, a forester might be able to look at your grove or look at the plantings and say, okay, there's something we can modify. But usually when trees are that far gone that the borers have moved in, it's not very much longer till they're even worse.
Bad. Okay, and just unrelatedly, are they related to the emerald ash borer?
No. Emerald ash borer is a specific species that attacks only trees in the genus Fraxinus. That would be green ash, white ash, black ash, pumpkin ash. There are related borers in oaks and other trees, but not that species of borer. There's a specific borer in oaks that's called the two-line chestnut borer, which is one of the scavengers that comes in on declining trees. They will look alike, but they're not the same species.
All right. Todd, thanks a lot for your call. Barb is up next in Des Moines. Hi, Barb.
Hi. Hi. I wanted to ask about, I have Creeping Jenny taking over my perennial and annual garden, and I was wondering what you would suggest how I could handle that And I had another question, if there was time.
Okay. Does that have a square stem and a scalloped leaf?
Yeah. Is it the same? I call it Creeping Jenny, but is it really Creeping Charlie?
I think it is, yes.
Okay,
if you have that, basically you're going to have to pull it out and dig it out. Now, the good news is that the ground ivy does not have a very deep or extensive root system, so you can pull it out and dig it out. The bad news is that it creeps along the ground, and as it does so, it roots. So if you leave a small portion on the ground, it will grow again next year, so you have to get it all. So just be very, very careful and pull it out and dig it out.
Okay. And I have a walnut tree in the front yard that I love.
Mm-hmm.
And to the side, I tried to start a perennial and annual garden. And some things have done well. Is it still the poison from that walnut? Am I not far enough away, or was that a dumb place to put a garden?
Well, it's not the best site for a lot of things, because a lot of things like full sun, where they want at least 6 hours of direct sun. And close to any big tree, they're obviously going to be shaded, and also you have the competition for water and nutrients. In the case of the walnut tree, they also produce a compound that affects the growth of some plants. So when you combine all those factors, a lot of things don't do well next to a walnut tree. So I would probably try things that can tolerate some shade, for example, and plant those in the area.
All right. We've got another Creeping Charlie question, so we'll get to that now. Earl wants to know, I sprayed for Creeping Charlie 4 weeks ago. I've heard that a second application should take place a month after the first. Should I still do it now, even though it's so warm?
No, absolutely. Do it this weekend if you can.
All right. He says, also, how short can my final mowing of the year be for Kentucky bluegrass?
I would probably mow it around maybe 2-2.5 inches the last time.
All right. Nancy asks, I have some daylilies, midnight salvia, and hydrangea in my flower garden. Is it best to cut them back now or wait until spring? If I wait until spring, would that give them some protection during the winter?
I basically clean up the perennials after they've been destroyed by a hard freeze. We haven't had that yet in most of Iowa, so they're still there. But typically, if you have the time, I do it in the fall. If you don't get to it, you can always do it next spring.
All right. Lynn asks, several weeks ago, I lifted and divided several patches of iris. There was some damage from iris borers. Seeking information on the borers on the internet, I looked at images of borers and damage. One image showed the underside of the rhizome with evenly spaced holes about the size of the lead in a mechanical pencil. The image attributed these holes to iris borers. Many of my rhizomes showed this pattern of holes, but I'm having difficulty reconciling these small holes with the size of the borers. Can you explain what's happening?
No, I really can't, although that's right. Never stopped me before. So
give it a try.
We're going to give it a try. Iris borer is a large caterpillar. It's in the cutworm group. They're quarter inch in diameter, and they'll be an inch or more in length. As they eat inside the rhizome, right, Richard?
Okay. Yes.
As they eat inside the rhizome, they frequently penetrate the outer covering, but not completely. And so it's typical for these little windows to have occurred where they sort of chewed up against the edge. Now, the second thing that happens is bacterial rot moves into those damaged rhizomes, and maybe the little round holes are just areas that decayed away. So two perfectly good guesses without a bit of data to support either one of them.
All right. Well, it sounds reasonable, though.
Yeah.
Thomas and Moline says, 3 weeks ago, the local utility company trimmed our 100-year-old oak tree. They claimed that Iowa State Extension says it's okay to trim oaks anytime after September 15th. However, with the warm weather, we're still concerned about oak wilt. Are they right? Is there anything we can do now to protect the tree?
You can't do anything at this point. I would say the best time by far is basically the winter months, December, January, February. The worst time to prune would be April through August. After August, the risk declines slowly. So, yes, it was much lower than it would have been in spring or early summer, but it wasn't quite zero like December, January, February.
And the other part about oak wilt is if you don't have oak wilt in your neighborhood to be picked up from one infested tree and moved to the wounds of the recently pruned tree, it takes that risk even lower. So there's lots of reasons for this to be low risk, but not zero risk, and all we can do is watch and wait.
Okay, so we can still be optimistic about that one.
I think so.
Much more optimistic than we were about the oaks with the borers in Algona.
All right. Here's a question from Larry on I-80 right now. Hi, Larry.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
My question is dealing with powdery mildew and downy mildew. I have no success with any broadleaf type vegetable, whether it's zucchini or pumpkins or squash. It doesn't seem to affect my my grape leaves, but I have sprayed it with soap and garlic oil and detergent, and I'm in a very sandy area, and so I seem to need a lot of water for things to grow. But often after just a few months, the plants die off.
Well, when you're dealing with a fungal disease, you're going to have to apply a fungicide at the very first sign of the disease, and hopefully control it. If it gets a major toehold, it's going to be very hard to control. So check your plants, monitor your plants frequently in the spring and summer. And when you first see those signs or symptoms, immediately apply your fungicide.
We could also mention spacing, airflow. Mm-hmm. These are things that might help reduce the incidence of those fungal diseases. So there's a few other things to consider here. And the water that you're applying to the plant may be helping the fungus more than it's hurting it.
All right. And let's slip in a couple email questions here as we get to the end of the hour. Linda says, my neighbor gave me some canna bulbs, which I've thoroughly enjoyed this year. I understand they're not winter hardy in Iowa. When should I dig them up? Do I remove the green parts, and how should they be stored?
Typically, we wait till we've had a killing frost or freeze, and then we dig them up. And I would cut them off maybe 4 or 5, 6 inches above the ground, dig them up, clean off all the dirt, let them dry for maybe a day or two, and then put them in a open box or crate and store them in a cool, dry location. And the really hard part is the temperature. You're looking for a temperature around 40, 45, 50. Definitely can't get it below freezing. And if it's too warm, they want to sprout. So basically 40, 45 to 50.
All right. And we are out of time, but we will be back again with Horticulture Day next Friday. With me today, Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron. Thank you, Richard.
You're welcome.
ISU Extension entomologist Donald Lewis. Thank you, Donald.
Thank you, Charity. It's always a pleasure.
And Kathleen Dellett, Iowa State University Extension organic specialist. Thank you, Kathleen.
Thank you, Charity.
And I want to mention again, the 16th Annual Iowa Organic Conference is coming up November 13th and 14th in Iowa City. Registration is still open. Talk of Iowa is produced by Iowa Public Radio. We had production assistance today from Divine Huff and Jason Burns. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa.